Hello, this is The Money. I'm Richard Ady. And today, we're about buyer beware. The pea and thimble trick, the con, the grift, the scam. They've always been with us. Smooth talkers and snake oil salesmen who know how to target the flaws in human nature and take us for a ride are a very old problem. But the internet is an enabling technology for them too. So this week, online scams. Let's start with the dimensions of the problem, how big it is. Peter Kell is the Deputy Chairman of the Australian Securities and Investments Commission, ASIC.
Scams are certainly a significant concern for ASIC, and I think for just about any agency that tries to protect the public from losing their money. They are growing in sophistication and frequency. The Australian Bureau of Statistics released a study last year showing that in the space of about 3 years, the number of people touched by scams went from 36% to 56% of the adult population. But we've got some very clever operators running these scams, and we've got hundreds of millions of dollars at a minimum being lost. I suspect it's a lot more, but there's significant underreporting.
I would imagine it's actually quite difficult to get a solid figure there.
It is very, very difficult to get a solid figure for a number of reasons. One is people are often embarrassed to report these sorts of losses. And in many cases, people may not even realise they've been scammed. So getting an accurate figure here can be quite tricky.
The ACCC has some numbers. Delia Rickard is its deputy chair.
The cost of online scams in Australia is growing every year. Last year, the ACCC had around $300 million reported to it and Acorn overall. Now, not all of that was from online scams. More than half of it certainly was. And it's growing the entire time, and that's a huge underreporting. The Australian Bureau of Statistics estimates that Australians lose about $3 billion a year to personal fraud, and a large chunk of that would be online.
And according to Professor Monica Whitty, who researches human factors in cybersecurity at Warwick University, losing the money is just the beginning.
On top of that, there's also the psychological losses as well, in the sense that a lot of people from a lot of these scams are quite upset, traumatised. Some even move to suicide, depending on the amount of money lost or the amount of hurt caused from the scam. For example, dating scam causes a lot of hurt for individuals where they thought they were having a real relationship with someone, and when they find out that it wasn't real, it's very devastating for those individuals. So besides the loss of money, there's also the psychological harm that's caused from these.
The dating or romance scam is both particularly lucrative and enormously damaging.
And this is the scam that causes the most devastation of all. We see enormous losses here. We see people mortgaging their homes, borrowing from families and friends to meet the demands of this person who supposedly loves them. Just this morning, I read a story around a suicide around this. It causes just emotional and financial devastation. And the scammers are very, very clever. They'll come online, they'll have, you know, make a friend request, but they will have checked you out beforehand, because with social media, if you don't have your privacy settings locked down, they can have a look at you beforehand, see what you're interested in, see the sorts of things you converse about, so that if their friend request is accepted, they can immediately start connecting in this way that you think, oh, wow, I found a like-minded soul.
Once you're hooked, the scammer reels you in.
They will quickly try and get you off the site. And if it's Facebook, off there, because Facebook does have some good detection mechanisms in place. And they will spend weeks or months grooming someone until they have their complete trust and the person believes, wow, I found my soulmate, my true love. And then they will start to ask for money. And they, once they get one bit, they'll ask for more and more and more. And it's got really nasty too, because of the extraordinary technology we have available to us these days, you'll share pictures, and often people end up sharing intimate video with the person they think they're in love with. And once they stop paying the scammer, once they realise it's a scam, the scammer will then come back and try and blackmail them. And they'll have access to all of their friends and family via Facebook and say, if you don't pay, I'm going to post this online. And sometimes we've heard stories, even where a person has paid, they have still posted it online.
It doesn't need to go that far to have a massive effect on the victim.
often what I write about is akin to a grieving process where they find it difficult to believe in the first place that they've been scammed, so they will move into denial. And they will keep up the relationship sometimes with the criminal, wanting to believe it's real. And when they really finally accept that they have been scammed, they've hurt, they feel angry, and they feel embarrassment and shame that they thought that they were spending a lot of time in a loving relationship that turned out not to be real.
If you're listening to this thinking, but how does this happen? How does someone get into this situation? You're not alone.
People often say, how is it that you can be scammed by someone you've never met? But if you look at the internet and how relationships are developed online, before there were any scams, people were developing highly personal, highly intimate relationships on the internet. And one of the reasons is because when we self-disclose to other people, we are showing that we trust that person. And when they self-disclose back to us, we feel like we have a reciprocal, intimate relationship. So when we build up a friendship, a romance, that's what automatically happens. But on the internet, we develop relationships more quickly and more intimately. This is why I think that people are more prone to these sorts of scams on the internet.
Why do birds suddenly appear every time you are near? Just like me, they long to be close to you. Why do stars fall down from the sky?
Internet scammers know what con men have always known. Humans have biases. We're not so good at thinking when our emotions get involved. We have buttons and they know how to push them. Peter Kell from ASIC.
In some ways, a good scam operator is almost a natural behavioural economist, is what we've found. They know how to really exploit people's decision-making biases, acting quickly, that sort of thing. So an example of that is to use what we call the anchoring bias. You could get $100,000, and so you've got the $100,000 in your mind, all you have to do is pay $500 up front as a transfer fee. If you've got the $100,000 in your mind, $500 may not seem that large. So one of the issues that we're looking at in ASIC is how can we get people to, if you like, overcome some of those behavioural biases, to slow down, to think more carefully, and maybe frame the offer that's being made to them.
But the people running the scams make that difficult to do.
They will set up profiles that look authentic. They will use lots of logos to make it look real. They will set up a narrative to make it seem persuasive. What they also do that's highly successful is that they try to get the user to respond very quickly. So they use urgency in the scam, saying that this money is needed right now so that people can't check to see if this is actually authentic or not. And the problem is, once people are into a scam, they find it very hard to leave the scam as well. They want to believe it's real. They want to believe that they will get their money back.
Once invested in something, we tend to ignore things that suggest we've made a mistake. It's called cognitive dissonance.
So every belief that we hold, that we want to maintain, if we see some evidence to suggest otherwise, we push that aside. So this is what happens. And the criminals are very good at convincing the user, even when they start to have doubts, that what they are doing is authentic and real. So with romance scam, people will say to the individual that they don't believe it's real, why don't you check this? And the criminal will come back saying, don't let anyone challenge our love. It's a real love, for instance. So whilst in that scam, what I argue, at least with romance scam and probably some other scams as well, is that individuals are groomed. So they're groomed into a relationship where they trust someone with all their money and their lives.
This is what happens with all scams, not just the romantic ones. Delia Rickard from the ACCC.
Some of the smaller scams are really effective. In terms of social media, the other huge growth area has been in fake online shops. And when I say that, I'm talking about you send money for goods and they never turn up. And they are proliferating everywhere. There's two types, the ones which just have this great sounding offer, but not too good to be true. They used to be, you know, 90% off. Now it would be 20, 30% off, something that sounds believable. You send your money, the goods don't turn up. The other thing that scammers do these days, you know, this is big business, it's organised crime, they are very, very tech savvy. They can do perfect replicas of a legitimate online store. And again, you think, oh, that's a known brand, that's a trusted entity, I'll be fine sending my money there. And again, they get your money, you get nothing in return.
And there's a variation on this, being convinced to pay for something after you haven't received it.
One of the other aspects of online scams is that they don't necessarily have to seek very large amounts of money from any particular individual for the scam to be successful. So if you're sending out requests to pay an invoice or some other sort of bill, and it may only be $90 or $100, well, if there's someone in the firm that receives that, that sounds reasonable, that doesn't sound outlandish, I'll just send it off. And if you've got thousands of people falling for that, well, you've actually got a very lucrative scam, and one where, because the amount isn't that large, often they go unreported.
It's easy to think of scams as affecting individuals, but the juiciest targets are bigger.
We see a lot of small businesses that get exploited by scam operators, in some ways because they're operating in an environment where people are offering them different sorts of services on a regular basis, and sometimes it can be hard within that to work out which ones are legitimate and which ones are illegitimate. But big businesses as well are obviously subject to all sorts of cyber attacks. And occasionally, they're also subject to significant scams. There have been some very large banks that have been the subject of very sophisticated scam operators. And that's one thing to emphasise. It's not all about silly-looking Nigerian letters. It can be very sophisticated, organised criminal networks.
What can you tell us about the banks being subject to those scams?
Well, one of the most significant cases in recent times was a large bank in Brazil, where one of the most senior members of the bank over time paid out hundreds of millions of dollars to scammers, and that caused very significant losses there. There have been other banks recently in the Philippines that have also been subject to these sorts of attacks. So if it's worthwhile, you will sometimes have scammers investing in that sort of effort, and there can be the problem of insiders as well.
So, Peter, have there been any successful prosecutions of online scammers in Australia?
Not a lot, partly because the operators are typically based outside the country, but we have had some significant joint operations with overseas law enforcement agencies. For example, in Thailand, we succeeded in having a whole lot of cold calling and online operators shut down. Similarly, we've had money frozen in different countries, but it is a big challenge. The operators will typically move on before law enforcement can crack down on them, especially if they're at the more sophisticated end of the market. And to give you an example, these people are sufficiently sophisticated that they will look to establish which jurisdictions they should set up in that don't have, say, treaties with a country like Australia that would allow criminals to be brought back here. They will consider those sorts of things in terms of deciding where they set up.
This is The Money on RN, the ABC Radio app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Ady. Today, we're looking at online scams, and there's a whole category we haven't talked about. Being tricked into giving someone else your information, access to your email or bank account, even control of your computer. Hugh Bradlow is president of the Australian Academy of Technology and Engineering. Hugh, how does this happen?
That's the frightening part, is there are many different ways in which it can happen. Basically, there are four ways in which people can attack you. They can attack you via your network connection. They can attack you via email. They can attack you via websites that you visit. And they can attack you by things that you plug into your computer, like USB sticks. And all of them are capable of either stealing account credentials or actually putting malware onto your machine.
So is the user just being naive?
It's not naive, because some of these attacks are extremely sophisticated. If you get a very plausible email from someone you know well, from their correct email address, and it's got a link in it that's to a, say, a website that you're interested in or that you've mutually been discussing, where they in effect can inject themselves into the actual conversation you're having with a person, it's very hard to see that that is a phishing attack. But when you click on the link, you can either introduce malware or you can, you know, inadvertently give your credentials. And, you know, that's a relatively easy thing to do if the email looks plausible enough.
Phishing, spelt P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G, is something you have to be aware of because you will encounter it.
The most common attack is a phishing attack where they send you an email which looks relevant to you and you click on a link and that link takes you to a website which then looks like a legitimate website and asks you to enter your username and password, and you then release your credentials, say for your email or your bank account. So, you know, one of the ways of protecting yourself is don't click on links and emails. If someone's asking you to re-enter your credentials, delete that site, put the actual website address into the taskbar at the top of the browser.
Hugh, I've heard of phishing, but what's spear phishing?
Spear phishing is actually targeting you as an individual. So knowing something about you, apparently journalists, by the way, are particularly prone to this because you've got a public profile and often are very high profile people, and therefore they can look up a lot about you on the internet and send you an email with a very specific message in it and a very specific type of fake link in it that would make you click on it because they know enough about you that you will be interested in that link.
How very reassuring that is. Makes me glad I've been on the radio for all this time.
In fact, I'm afraid to tell you, there are now computer programs where you can fake people's voices very accurately. And, you know, you can type in text and it will produce a speech that sounds exactly like someone. And all they need is a few minutes of your voice. So I'm afraid, yes, that is a growing threat in the future where they can do voice imitation very effectively from a computer and make it say anything you want.
Right. What about you using your own voice in the wrong way? Because I understand you can be tricked into calling a premium rate number.
That is a scam that's been around for quite some time, but generally the telcos will detect that and shut it down very quickly. So it does happen, especially as nowadays it's very easy to buy a telephone number very cheaply from virtually any country in the world and pretend you're phoning from a particular area, and then getting people to either call back or to, for example, click on a link in an SMS that will allow you to make a call, which is to a premium call number. But as I say, I think those do tend to get shut down very quickly.
That is positive. Do we have the technologies to track down the perpetrators of some of the other scams?
It's doable. It's very expensive because usually they use heavily disguised means of communicating. So in a lot of cases, they will actually take over a computer somewhere in the world which is not even related to where they are. And then that becomes an intermediary. So even if you trace that intermediary, you've somehow got to be able to get yourself back to the command and control center. And these guys use techniques like the onion router, which make it very hard to track down where they originate. I understand that it is possible, but it's not easy and it's very expensive for law enforcement to do it.
By now, you're probably asking yourself a question. How can people make this sort of mistake? Peter Kell,
people think, well, I wouldn't fall for this. I'm not a silly person. But falling for a scam is not like failing a maths test. It's more like falling in love with the wrong person. It's an emotional decision rather than some sort of failure of making a rational calculation. And that's one thing we have to get across.
Actually, that's a difficult thing to get across because you're right. I think most of us think, well, I wouldn't do that.
Well, that's right. And sitting here now, having this discussion and thinking about things rationally, you wouldn't do it. But we have different modes of decision-making. And if the emotional decision-making kicks in, well, that can make things more difficult.
So who's susceptible to the online scam? Monica Whitty from Warwick University has been researching exactly that.
In terms of the psychological profile of scams in general, what I found is people that are high on impulsivity are more likely to be scammed, especially those who react very quickly to things, who see something as urgent and need to respond to that immediately. I've also found that people who have an internal locus of control are more likely to be prone to being scammed. So that means thinking that they have control over a particular issue when in reality they don't necessarily have the full control. So they think that they may be invulnerable to scams, for instance. The other variable I found that people who have a more addictive disposition are more likely to be scammed. So they're more likely to be taken away by the scam. But importantly, what I've also found is that particular behaviours online will make people more susceptible. So doing a lot of shopping online, doing a lot of instant messaging, posting pictures, doing more of those things online make people more susceptible to scams. And that's probably because they're more exposed to those.
That makes sense. You're not only more exposed, you're spending less time in the real world. But are there warning signs?
Anything where the request is, please send some money up front, especially if it's money going overseas, please send some money up front for us to either refund you a larger amount or unfreeze your bank account or that sort of thing. That advance fee request is a big warning sign. Your bank won't do that. Any sort of reputable business won't do that. Another one is asking for a lot of personal information, your credit card details, your address, perhaps even your passport number. Think to yourself, would I normally provide these to undertake a transaction of the sort that's involved here? And I think in 99.9% of cases, the answer would be no.
The ACCC, our competition regulator and consumer champion, is getting this message out there. But what else is it doing? Delia Rickard.
What we've chosen to do is to focus on working with the banks and the money remitters such as Western Union PayPal. So they have best practices in place to detect when money's going to scammers, both through really good training of frontline staff, but even more importantly, working with data which we provide them and they get from their own complaints to get a sense of where the scammers are operating, what route the money's going through, understanding people's normal payment patterns to see if something's out of the ordinary, and then delaying payments, getting in contact with victims, having the conversation to work out whether or not it is a scam. So we've done a lot of work with the banks this year and we're continuing, and some good processes are being put in place. Some of them are doing some really terrific work. Likewise, we're working with Facebook, which seems to be the main social media platform that scammers are using. Now, they also have a lot of very sophisticated processes in place, but we hope when people report their scams to us, we ask if they're prepared to share it with the banks and the entities that they met through. And if they say yes, we're hoping to share that information with them so they've got a fuller picture of how these scams are working to sort of further refine their detection mechanisms.
The key is protecting yourself. And Hugh Bradlow says some of that is simple.
The first thing is people should use what's called two-factor authentication, where to get into important sites like your email site, you not only use a username and password, but you use some other form of identification, which is usually based on your mobile phone. So it could be a SMS that they send you with a code and you have to type in, or it could be an actual app on the phone that generates a code and you type that in when you log in. That makes it much more difficult for someone who's stolen your username and password to get access to your account. So that's the first thing. The second thing is you should make sure that your computer and your operating system and your applications are all up to date, that they've been patched, as they say. Because what happens is hackers exploit code vulnerabilities, and these code vulnerabilities are almost impossible to avoid because we're talking about operating systems with millions of lines of code, and therefore people inevitably will make mistakes in writing them.
The ACCC has advice as well.
Pretty much every scam we see these days is a combination of people wanting your money but also wanting your personal information. ID theft is huge business. They put parcels of information about you together and then they sell it. There's a fortune in it. So if somebody contacts you out of the blue, and they'll usually be pretending to be a government department, a utility, a telco, a trusted brand, and starts asking you for personal information, don't give them a thing. Hang up or hit delete if you think it might be legitimate. Get the real contact details for the organisation and call them and check it out. Never, ever give your bank account details to anyone, credit card number, because they will scam you there. Nor do you give people remote access to your computer ever. And think about how people are asking to be paid, because if they're asking for a wire transfer, it's a scam. It's just that simple.
Monica Whitty from Warwick University has thought about this a lot.
Partly it's about looking for cues that they think might be deceptive cues, but sometimes that's quite challenging. So when it comes to dating, for instance, my recommendation is people get other people involved and they listen to their friends and their family if they think that something is not quite right. When it comes to online dating, my suggestion is also meet a person that you meet on a profile straight away as soon as you can to check out, are they authentic, are they real? If they use excuses for why they can't meet you, then leave that relationship and move on to something else, no matter how genuine they seem, no matter how perfect that individual seems to you. When it comes to looking at shopping, looking at giving money to investments, do your research about those investments. Don't be pulled away by something that looks quite remarkable. Take your time and check it out. We find that people think that they're being involved in a job and they're going to be paid for this job that's not real, that they've found employment on online sites. These online sites are genuine, but some of these jobs are not genuine. So check, ask questions. If people are trying to get you to buy something, trying to get you to invest in something, ask many, many questions. Take your time. Don't give money until you've checked out the whole scenario.
Nobody wants to go through this. It makes you feel like a mug. It might leave you heartbroken. But if you do, Peter Kell says, it's really valuable if you report it.
I'm afraid to say in many cases, we're not going to be able to retrieve the money, but it will help ensure that we're able to, for example, target our warnings to the people that need them most. We've worked with different agencies, for example, on looking at people who seem to be sending large amounts of money overseas for no particular reason. And when you understand who's most at risk, and you can do that if people are prepared to report, well, then you can hopefully prevent someone else from falling into that trap.
Peter Kell is the Deputy Chairman of the Australian Securities and Investments Commission. You also heard from Professor Monica Whitty from Warwick University, the Deputy Chair of the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, Delia Rickard, and President of the Australian Academy of Technology and Engineering, Hugh Bradlow. You'll find more details on our homepage at abc.net.au/rn. The Money is produced by Kate Piercy. Our sound engineer is Jennifer Parsonage. I'm Richard Ady. Yeah.